They feel like memories, and that's why I thought I needed a term for these very powerful fears and terrors that children, you know, that we inherit for experiences that we didn't ourselves live, but that we feel like we remembered. So I guess the fear right now is that it's not only the children right now, but it's the, you know, it's the future generations that will, how they will receive this moment of fear that is spreading across the country with people losing visas, losing status, even the stories of green card holders, but citizens possibly, and naturalized citizens like me, possibly being denationalized and like you. So, I think the reverberations of this could reach future generations, and what we're transmitting is extremely concerning to me, and I hope we're transmitting resistance, resilience, and refusal.
Marianna Hirsch, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Columbia University Professor Emerita, her recent piece in the Foreword, "I grew up under a terrifying authoritarian regime. Mahmoud Khalil's arrest is right out of their playbook." That does it for our show. I want to wish a happy birthday to David Prude and a belated happy birthday to Matt Ely. Our condolences to our executive director, Julie Crosby, on the passing of her aunt, and also to Nermeen Sheikh on the passing of her dad. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kotek announces millions of dollars of help aimed at helping the houseless community. Oregon's members of Congress are pushing back against new legislation they say will make it harder, especially for women, to vote. And wildlife advocates worry that Washington's wolf population is dropping. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 10th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has launched a new pilot project aimed at helping unsheltered Oregonians dealing with mental illnesses. Grants will go out to individual counties to connect people who need housing with homes and with behavioral health services. KBOO reporter Kenny has more.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has announced the launch of new Housing 360 initiative. Housing 360 is part of the Oregon Rehousing Initiative Governor Kotek launched after declaring state of emergency in Oregon 2023 for the unsheltered homelessness crisis. Over $3 million in grants will be awarded to different Oregon counties and organizations that focus on the initiative's goals. This part of the initiative aims to improve long-term housing stability, finding effective behavioral health treatments, all while reducing racial bias in these services. The initiative could help provide up to 24 months of rental assistance and services that help sustain long-term housing, such as employment, behavioral health, and childcare services. This strategy will put a greater emphasis on local-level solutions that can address unique needs. Homeless No More statistics show that at least 11,000 individuals in Multnomah County are experiencing homelessness. About 43% are women who have faced domestic violence and economic hardships. About 42% are 45 and older, with significant portion being older than 55. People of color have been disproportionately affected in the homelessness crisis due to discrimination and bias when obtaining housing and treatment services. Portland aims to reduce unsheltered homelessness by 50% in 2025 with an updated homeless response plan that help provide more shelter beds, supportive housing units, and expanding services for behavioral health and substance use treatment. With KBOO Evening News, I'm Kenny.
Four University of Oregon students have had their student visas revoked, leaving the school scrambling to support them on short notice. KBOO's Alexis Ponce has more.
University of Oregon administrators have revealed that three more students are at risk of deportation after their visas have been revoked by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The University of Oregon now has four confirmed international students who have had their visas revoked based on unspecified criminal charges. In the past month, colleges around the country have reported up to 150 international students' visas being revoked unexpectedly and have lost permission to stay in the United States. University spokesperson Eric A. Howell said in a statement, quote, "We are working closely with all students directly impacted to gather all relevant information, connect them with legal advice, provide academic and personal life advising, and otherwise help them navigate next steps," end quote. At the University of Oregon, administrators only discovered the four revocations from checking the National Student Visa Database, known as SEVIS. Howell said the university is not required to check the database, but began doing so as a, quote, "matter of professional commitment," end quote, and in order to give international students advance warning. The University of Oregon international students hail from roughly 90 countries, with most coming from East Asia.
The union representing Portland's police is pushing back against possible budget cuts as the city of Portland faces a big budget deficit.
Aaron Schmalz, I'm the president of the Portland Police Association. The PPA represents, I think, a lot more people than people recognize, and we do represent our police officers, our sergeants, detectives, criminalists, public safety support specialists, but we also represent our dispatchers and our dispatch supervisors. I used to work for records. I think there's such a connective tissue between all the work that's done in public safety in our community, and all this work is very essential. Looking at the time we're in right now as we navigate difficult budgets and where we're at, Mayor Wilson has spoken a lot about wanting to restore public safety and navigate some very difficult issues in our city. And I think it's important to look and hear from the public about how they want that work done. Our perspective has been for quite some time that we do need a very integrated public safety response model. As much as it is super important that we staff up BOIC, we've done a really good job working through their overtime significant deficit and making sure that people are available to answer the phone when people call and ask for help. We also want to make sure that we also have responders available to go to those calls. From my perspective, building a holistic and woven public safety system is critical. It's also critical that we create an environment where warm handoffs are available and very, very necessary. From my perspective, looking at things like peers for addiction services, our deflection system, PSR, all these other things, these systems continuing to grow in partnership are critical because historically law enforcement has not had quick access to those services. And the quicker we can hand off that work, I think the outcomes become better. It's important that the Police Bureau and BOIC are nimble to evolve and meet ever-changing needs. Again, having, you see in dispatch, having mental health specialists on the floor, having other options for patrol to hand things off. Again, navigating the big asks of law enforcement, but also building relationships. And on that, cultivating partnership and strengthening the relationships we have with community. It is so important that Portlanders know who's coming when they call and that the face that shows up is one that's familiar. Our police officers are and should be a big part of the infrastructure of our city. From a crime reduction standpoint, the Police Bureau has always said we want to reduce crime and the fear of crime. But I think it's important that we revitalize a community safety or a community policing model and that we're able to be both reactive and proactive to things facing our city. A big problem in our city is that we are just critically understaffed. The Manhattan Institute released a report recently that says that Portland is uniquely ill-equipped to deal with the problem of understaffing because our police department is uniquely understaffed. With just under 1.26 police officers per thousand, the Portland Police Bureau ranks 48th among the nation's 50 largest cities for staffing to population. And as a result, the PPB struggles to provide even the most basic of services, at times taking up to a half hour to respond to high priority calls. Similarly, our allocation and budgeting, we do hear a lot about how much money we're spending on policing, but our allocation for budgeting as you rank us with other cities is at the bottom or towards the bottom with just 3.6% of our budget. A lot of conversations recently about overtime. 100% overtime is a crutch to navigate the difficult times we're in, but it's not wasteful. If you want to address this problem, the heart of that problem, the goal is to hire more officers. We saw this work in dispatch through double time and then a heavy staffing effort to get themselves back up. And then now their overtime expenditures have just completely gone down as a result of being down to about, I think they're down to about six FTE that they're looking to hire. If we hire more officers, we will see our overtime situation improve. Put bluntly, overtime is needed now to plug holes, to do missions, and to do the extra work we're doing. But my hope is we can move back to where overtime is rare and our officers are getting the correct amount of rest and respite, and we're seeing officers be able to thrive on their basic wage. The long-term solution there is to invest. I want to make sure, again, to the points that I've heard before me today, that all of these public safety groups are critical, that we're investing in a robust and thorough public safety system that can respond to the community's needs. And even given the pressures that we have this year, we want to make sure that we're investing in public safety because it is our city's highest priority.
Republicans in Congress have for a second time passed a bill that would require proof of citizenship to vote in federal elections and impose voter roll purges requirements on states. They call the legislation the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act, which passed in a 220 to 208 vote with help from four Democrats, including Washington's Marie Glusenkamp Perez. However, two Oregon congresswomen, both Democrats, pleaded with lawmakers to vote it down. Here's Representative Maxine Dexter.
Today, House Republicans betrayed their mothers, their sisters, their daughters, and every woman in their life. The SAVE Act is an anti-woman, anti-democracy voter suppression bill cloaked in lies about election integrity. With this vote, House Republicans have jeopardized access to the ballot box for nearly 70 million American women. That isn't just a number, it's personal. It's the working mom in Sandy who can't afford to take time off work to go get paperwork. It's the woman in Portland whose name no longer matches her birth certificate and doesn't have $160 for a passport. In the year 2025, I cannot believe I have to come to the House floor to argue for a woman's right to vote. But I will fight this Republican effort to disempower women today and every single day if I need to. As a mother, I will not allow this country to continue to strip our daughters of their rights. We cannot force them to grow up in a world where they have fewer rights than their mothers and grandmothers. I call on my Senate colleagues to show courage and defeat this despicable
expired.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
And here's Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici.
I rise today in strong opposition to the SAVE Act. This bill will make it more difficult to register to vote, and it will prevent millions of American citizens, including married women who changed their name, and rural Americans from exercising their right to vote. It creates an enormous and expensive unfunded mandate on election offices, and for what? Federal law already requires people to attest under penalty of perjury that they are U.S. citizens when they register to vote. Non-citizens attempting to register to vote is exceedingly rare, and if they do, they face severe consequences, including fines up to 5 years in prison and deportation. Mr. Speaker, more than 140 million Americans do not have a passport. Approximately 70 million women do not have a birth certificate that matches their current legal name. And millions of rural voters would have to travel long distances to try to register to vote. We don't have to guess what would happen if this bill were to pass. In 2011, Kansas had a proof of citizenship requirement that actually prevented more than 30,000. Can I have an extra 15 seconds? Thank you. In Kansas, more than 30,000 U.S. citizens, 12% of everyone seeking to register to vote, were barred from voting. Other states have tried, and in all of them, significant number of citizens have been wrongly barred from voting. It's unacceptable. It's voter suppression, and it's wrong.
Both of Oregon's U.S. senators are warning about a new budget blueprint from the Republicans. Today, the U.S. House narrowly adopted the plan for slashing taxes and government spending along party lines. Here are some thoughts from Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden.
Donald Trump is raising inflation and causing chaos in the markets. And significantly, he admits to be doing it on purpose. The rest of the world is figuring out how to realign without us and leave our economy, workers, and businesses behind. What Donald Trump did yesterday has the look of some awfully sketchy market manipulation. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and Republicans are working overtime to ram through the Congress a tax bill that amounts to a multi-trillion dollar bailout for billionaires and big corporations. This committee has another opportunity to question a Trump official on what I think the central issue is with respect to these tariffs. What is the plan? Donald Trump has proven that no one, not the American people, not our trading partners, no one can trust what he says. Everybody who works for him has got a different story, in fact, to explain what all the chaos is supposed to accomplish. It's possible the reason they can't give a straight answer is these tariffs aren't designed to solve an actual trade or economic challenge. They're designed to soak typical workers with higher taxes in order to have money to have more handouts for people at the upper portion of the top. According to the Nonpartisan Joint Committee on Tax, the price tag for the Trump Republican tax agenda is now up to $7 trillion. And the biggest winners by far will be big corporations and the wealthy. Republicans have locked our side of the aisle out of this debate. There's no discussion of the biggest economic challenges Americans are facing today. They're not talking about how to build more housing, which is what I hear about at all of my town meetings. Rent, mortgages, housing. No talk about it here, though. Lots of talk about it at my town halls. The Trump people aren't talking about how to increase wages and create more good-paying jobs. Not talking about how to help Americans find affordable health care. They're not talking about helping parents with astronomical costs of childcare. But they're spending plenty of time on the agenda of the billionaires and multinational corporations and thinking a lot about how everybody else is going to be on the hook to pay for them.
And here are some comments about the budget plan from U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley.
Families lose, billionaires win. That's the Republican plan. Slashes $2 trillion from the programs families depend on to thrive in order to give more tax giveaways to the very richest Americans. Families lose $2 trillion in core programs slashed to deliver another $2 trillion to the richest Americans. That's a terrible plan. How about families thrive? How about billionaires pay their fair share? Now, there's a good plan we ought to be all able to get behind. But there's even more that's wrong with this Republican plan. A new estimate of the cost of their plan in new debt over the next 10 years, $7 trillion. That's trillion with a T. $1 trillion. Unpaid for tax cuts, with most of it going to the richest Americans. But there's even more bad news, because they want to extend that deficit debt creating machine into the future. And CBO tells us that will cost $37 trillion at a minimum in new debt. $37 trillion. That's awfully hard to get your hands around. $37 trillion in new debt. But there's even more bad news. They want to tell the American public their plan produces no new debt. They have this new version of the world in which they simply wave away the debt and say, pretend it didn't exist. It's called magic math. Why are we doing a bill that takes away from core health care, housing, and education programs for families to add more wealth to the billionaires? With this one bill alone, Republicans are giving $22 trillion to the wealthiest 10% of Americans, while the bottom 10% get enough to buy a cup of coffee. Here's a cup of coffee. Don't drink it all in one place. Take a little sip each day of the year, because that's all you get. Our plan is different. Democrats are fighting for families. We're fighting for health care, for Medicaid. We're fighting for health care because it is a foundation on which families thrive. We're fighting for education because it's a foundation on which families thrive. It is very disturbing to me, very disturbing to every American who sees that all we're doing under the Republican vision is increasing wealth inequality, undermining the programs for families to stand on to thrive, and proceeding to enrich the richest people in our nation. But while running on fiscal responsibility since 1996, the Republican Party has been the party of fiscal irresponsibility, changing the Senate rules to run up deficits and debt, giving away the Treasury to the richest Americans, and imposing that massive debt on the families in the future. It's hard to get your hands around what their $37 trillion debt plan means, But think about it like this. Lined up behind him, but not just those three, also the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, the billionaire owner of Tesla and SpaceX and Starlink, and now, infamously, the name behind Doge, who spent more than $250 million to elect Trump and my Republican colleagues. And those are just the contributions we know about. We don't know about all the dark money they may have spent, slashing programs families rely on to give trillions of dollars to the richest Americans. That's the Republican plan. Billionaires who don't care if we slash Medicaid, they don't care if grocery prices go up, they don't care about the cost of housing or prescription drug prices or health insurance, because they're billionaires. What costs to us a month's salary for them is a 1 second blip in their financial landscape.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airways. Tonight's weather, cloudy, a low around 45. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy to partly cloudy skies, a high of 59. Today in history, on this date in 1866, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was founded by philanthropist and diplomat Henry Berg. The quote of the day is from Berg. Arguing for protection of animals, he said, "This is a matter purely of conscience. It has no perplexing side issues. It is a moral question in all of its aspects." Rural Nevada is facing a transportation and housing crisis. More on that from Alex Gonzalez.
Advocates for those with disabilities say things are getting out of hand. Dee Dee Foremaster with the Rural Center for Independent Living says there isn't enough available low-income housing and adds the units that are available to folks on the Housing Choice Voucher Program are often substandard. She adds the average Nevadan on Social Security receives almost $1,000 a month, but the average Nevadan can expect to pay around $1,400 a month in rent.
People are having to double up to be able to make their rent, and it makes it difficult because a lot of times some people with disabilities really would prefer to live by themselves.
Foremaster says she and others feel like the calls they're making for housing reform are falling on deaf ears. And while local leaders are eyeing federal lands as part of the solution to address the housing shortage, Foremaster says she has solutions that are more immediate. They include creating a program for landlords to receive tax incentives for allocating units to low-income Nevadans. Foremaster adds that even in rural Nevada, the housing supply isn't able to keep up with demand. She says easing restrictions on accessory dwelling units would help everyone.
So that people have an array of plans to be able to draw from that are approved, so they don't have to go through the building commission and hoops that we all have to jump through every time we want to build something on a property.
Margaret Marcucci is part of the center's ELCO staff. She says another issue impacting people's daily lives is lack of transportation.
I won't tell you how many times I get called from friends going, "I'm stuck. Can you come get me? Or can you take me to an appointment?" A lot of our seniors and a lot of disabled do not go to the doctor because they can't get there.
Last year, a free rideshare program launched in rural Nevada to help remove barriers to access medical care. But Marcucci's calling for a more diversified and flexible fleet of services that can get folks to where they need to go. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
In Washington, some wildlife advocates are worried about a new report from the state. Isabel Charlet explains.
A new Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife report showing the state's wolf population fell nearly 10% last year. The vast majority of the wolves were illegally and legally killed by humans. The report also shows the number of successful breeding pairs, a key population indicator, dropped 25% last year. Amarouk Weiss of the Center for Biological Diversity says 7 illegal killings are under investigation, though the true number is likely higher.
For every animal you find that has been illegally killed, there are 1 to 2 additional animals that were also illegally killed whose deaths will never be discovered.
Since 2016, wolf deaths in the state have continued to rise. Last year, the Fish and Wildlife Commission rejected a proposal to reduce protections for wolves from state endangered to state sensitive because of increased deaths. Weiss says many myths about wolves need debunking. She notes that predator-related livestock deaths are rare, with most losses caused by issues like dehydration and birthing complications. In Washington, wolf-related losses made up less than a tenth of a percent of livestock deaths in 2024. Weiss emphasizes that wolves are crucial for healthy ecosystems because they prevent overbrowsing by deer and elk.
That allows vegetation to grow back, and that provides building materials for beaver and nesting materials for migrating neotropical birds. It provides all kinds of habitat for other species.
Weiss explains that Washington's wolf plan splits the state into three recovery regions, aiming for breeding pairs in each. The third region, encompassing the Southern Cascades and North Coast, does not have any. As more wolves are killed in eastern Washington, Weiss says, fewer are left to move west, and those that do often fall victim to illegal killings. Weiss says she wants the state to maintain protections for wolves.
And really do a lot more public education to help people understand we can live with them and that we need them.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Health advocates are slamming a U.S. House move that could lead to massive Medicaid cuts. Suzanne Potter reports California groups that fight for greater access to health care are criticizing the Republicans' budget.
Republicans can only afford to lose a couple of votes in order to use reconciliation to pass the bill on a simple majority vote. So Karen Savage Sangwan with the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network is asking voters to get in touch with their local member of Congress.
Devastating health care cuts can still be stopped. With the slimmest of a majority in the House of Representatives, it would take less than a handful of House Republicans to vote no on this plan to save health care for 15 million Californians who count on Medi-Cal.
The House version of the budget blueprint calls for $880 billion in cuts to the part of the government that funds health care for low-income families, seniors, and people with disabilities. House Speaker Mike Johnson has said the savings are necessary to fund President Donald Trump's other budget priorities. Adriana Ramos Yamamoto is a senior policy analyst with the California Budget and Policy Center.
Republicans want to cut funding for basic health care in order to help pay for tax cuts that disproportionately benefit the wealthy and corporations.
Amanda McAllister-Wallner is interim director of the nonprofit Health Access. She notes that Congress will soon adjourn for a two-week break, sending lawmakers back to their districts.
When these members are home in their district, we want to make sure that they're hearing from constituents and that they are accountable when they go back to DC and they start talking about the details of this plan.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
President Trump pauses tariffs for 90 days as Republicans join the chorus of questions on his trade policy, and a new federal executive order incentivizes coal for energy use but poses risk to public lands. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2025 Talks.
Every country in the world who wants to come and negotiate, we are willing to hear you. We're going to go down to a 10% baseline tariff for them, and China will be raised to 125 due to their insistence on escalation.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says duties on Chinese goods are being raised while President Donald Trump pauses most of his tariff increases for 90 days. Trump's about-face caused a sharp rebound in the U.S. stock markets that recently crashed. But it's unclear what deals the White House will be able to strike. The European Union may still follow China's path and impose retaliatory levies. While most congressional Republicans stood by Trump's policy, some, like North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, sound more than a little frustrated. He aired his questions with U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer in a hearing.
In this scenario, the decision maker who decided the alla prima approach, who has obviously had to have spent time anticipating what we saw in the markets and some of the pushback, I'm assuming this all got gamed out. Because it's a novel approach, it needed to be thought out. Whose throat do I get to choke if this proves to be wrong?
Democrats are calling for Trump to repeal all the levies instead of pausing them. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Trump's repeated reversals and inconsistent positions amount to government by chaos.
You cannot run a country with such chaos, with such unpredictability, with such lack of understanding of what's going on in the world and the facts.
Meanwhile, Trump signed several executive orders aimed at bolstering the coal industry. One calls for all federal agencies to repeal regulations the order says are discriminating against coal, and another waives certain Biden-era air pollution rules for some coal-fired power plants at risk of closing. Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso says what he calls clean coal from his state is needed now more than ever.
Available, affordable, reliable. This has powered our nation for over a century, continues to be a major source of power for our nation, and we need it far into the future.
The price of renewable energy has dropped so quickly it produced more power than coal last year, and coal employment fell more quickly during Trump's first term than under President Joe Biden. But the Trump administration is moving aggressively to open public land to energy production. A new study finds 15,000 mining claims in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming are within 30 miles of a national park or monument. Bo Kicklis with the National Parks Conservation Association says it only takes 3 years to get a claim.
That's pretty fast when you think about the potential threats that are associated with mining, like impacts to groundwater and water supply for communities, wildlife migration and habitat, air impacts. You think about other public land uses like recreation and conservation and so forth.
He says the leases are already too easy to get even before legislation in the Senate, which aims to further loosen the process. He calls this a real threat to the protected landscapes in national parks and monuments. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 10th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Alexis Ponce, Kenny, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, up next.